Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night to you all. Happy September. Hope everybody had a great weekend. I did. It was fantastic. Got to go and do some hibachi action with my mother for her birthday. It was great. Had tons of friends who had birthdays over the weekend too. So happy birthday to all you guys. Happy birthday and blessings to any of you listeners that had special days over the weekend. We've got a great show tonight. In the second part, we will be joined by our good friend and exorcist, Archbishop James Cloud. We will be talking about end times prophecies, specifically signs of the times as listed in the Bible, things like that. And precisely what a prophecy is, you know, because these words get used and overused so frequently, same as paranormal is, as we say on the show so regularly, a Kleenex box, kind of a catch-all term. It's almost the same way with that. So we will be getting into what's the difference between clairvoyance and prophecy. Is Nostradamus a prophet or not? So we'll be getting into that, and we'll be getting into specifically end time prophecies. We'll be also getting into some of what we'll be talking about with our first guest tonight, which is Marshall Applewhite and the Heaven's Gate cult. I'm going to throw air quotes up there for our listeners who are not viewing online. Air quotes cult. And I'm one of those that I don't know. He did claim to be a Christ consciousness rebirthed on earth. But did he claim to be Jesus straight out? I don't know, man. So we'll be getting into that. And our first guest in the show is Mindy Topfish. She is the author of Dying to Meet Them. She is director of online education and everything for MUFON and for MUFON University. She is also the curator of the Hayden Hughes Archives and the current owner of the International UFO Bureau, founded by Hayden Hughes. Welcome back to the show, Mindy Topfist. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. I had the great pleasure of coming up there and hanging out with you. I mean, we, of course, know each other through MUFON and through your book and through your near-death experience. But while at MUFON, we got to talking about this incredible archive of Hayden Hughes that you had and the importance of archiving such things. And how did you come to be in possession of this archive to begin with? Because it is a vast, vast tome of data. It's huge. It's a massive amount of stuff. So how did you come to be in possession of this to begin with and come to carry on the task of the International UFO Bureau as started by Hayden Hughes?
I know. It's a big shoes to fill here, to be carrying on his name and his legacy. And I had, whenever I first got involved with MUFON, about a year into it, I became state director of Oklahoma, and I figured, well, I guess I'm the expert here now, so let me go back up and see, you know, some of the history of UFO sightings here in Oklahoma. I had read through stuff before just kind of out of curiosity, but I knew that I really needed to cement my knowledge of, you know, past sightings. Yeah. And when I was doing that, I kept coming across Hayden Hughes, and I was flabbergasted to find out that he had actually been out in Hartshorne, which was the site of the schoolyard encounter that I investigated a few years back for MUFON. And living here in Oklahoma City, I had never heard of hartshorn before. Wow. So find out that Hayden was actually out there in the 60s and 70s just blew my mind. This little town only has maybe 2,000 people there. And for the amount of sightings that they've had, it's just incredible. So my main goal at that point was to get a hold of Hayden and see if I could collaborate with him and find out more about what he was doing out there and what he was finding in hartshorn. Well, whenever I went to find his contact info, I found out that he had passed in 2017. Mm. And that led me down the path to finding his widow. And funny enough, she lives across the street from me.
Wow.
So I contacted her and I said, you know, I would really like to look through Hayden's files, if you still have them, and kind of see what he was doing out in the hartshorn region. And she said, well, honey, I've still got all of his files and you're welcome to have them because I think you would know what to do with them. And at the time I thought, okay, I'll go through them. I can get them all, you know, put in order. And I reached out to MUFON with their initiative with Project Aquarius and said, hey, I've got these Hayden Hughes files if we want to put them on Aquarius. And of course, they said, yeah, let's get them up there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with you coming out last weekend, and the listeners should know you did not sleep. I mean, you got, what, 3 hours of sleep a night?
It was about three or four a night. Yeah, yeah. It was about 45 hours of hardcore archiving over 3 days. So,
yeah. Well, putting up with me, and it was funny enough, just to let the listeners know, one day I was so tired, I said, I'm going to go take a nap. And I woke up, it was like 1 p.m, and I was like, oh my God, Chris is here working, and I've been asleep all day. I run in here and find Chris. He's gone through all the boxes, and he's pretty much completed it while I was sleeping.
Granted, I don't know if I would have had the spare time to coalesce the idea of, you know, a lot of these archives belong in a book. I don't know if I would have had time to coalesce or think about that idea had we been sitting there and cutting up and talking while I was scanning things and doing stuff as usual, you know?
Yeah, so. You did your best work while I was sleeping. So whenever I came out, you know, here you come with all these wonderful ideas. And just over the last 2 weeks, the amount of work that you put in and that we've been able to come together and bring to life. Yeah, here we go. The Hayden Hughes UFO Research Center, which we're launching now to make all of these files available to the public. And some of the amazing technology you're going to be putting behind it. I cannot wait. I am tickled pink.
It is exciting. It is very exciting. And, you know, when it comes to things like this, Mindy, as I've said numerous times on the show, research does not happen in a vacuum. It can't, like, by definition. And the whole reason for the birth of the internet to begin with was for labs and researchers to be able to share data in real time. You know,
right.
So the idea that, yes, somewhere out there are other vast troves of data. And it doesn't matter if it's clipped newspaper articles because somebody was into it. If it's collected pictures, you know, that were purchased, because there were literally things within Hayden's archive where it was like he had purchased them. Somewhere, like it was a couple of negatives with a story and things like that. Like he had clearly purchased these from a person, you know, who was like, okay, I'll give you the negatives, you know, and it has the price written on there, all kinds of things. It was pretty fascinating to see that, and even to once again see how an archive like that is collected and put together. You had probably about at the beginning, 5 or 6 banker's boxes full of stuff, you know, I think, and just to get obsessive on it, we probably sat and watched, because I know I watched quite a bit while you were asleep. But we probably watched a conglomerate 30, 40 hours of footage on Heaven's Gate. 30 oh, yeah. to 40 hours.
I mean, recovering from that after a weekend.
And you wonder why I might be a little sympathetic now, you know?
Yeah.
maybe the 40 hours did something to me, Mindy. But quite literally, that was a huge thing that Hayden was largely into and so deep into. I'm not going to say deep into it because it wasn't like he was involved, but they came to him regularly, yep, like with updates, that's things like that. Yep. They came and talked to him. And he even said, like, they came to my office and they just like, I turned around, and when I turned back around seconds later, they were gone. There was no car. There was nothing. Like, they gave me a code to contact them, and after I used the code, I got a phone call. Like, after I used the code. So yeah, interesting that even over, and that was one that, as opposed to a lot of cults that are pretty fast burn, you know, maybe a decade or something like that, Heaven's Gate went on for 20 something years.
Right.
Throughout its incarnations.
There's actually an article on my website on MindyTotFest.com, and I'm sure we're going to be bringing some of that over to HaydenHughes.com, because a whole section of my website is dedicated to some of the stuff before we even got it digitized. Yeah, there it is. But under, just if you scroll down right there, it actually has an article on there that says that Hayden Hughes was almost convinced. Yeah, right here. And it was written by Sean Castile, and I reached out to him, and he said, sure, absolutely, put it on the website. But it talks about those different instances that you brought up. And then there was a third one where he had one of his colleagues draw three different types of commonly reported aliens, and the humanoid type of alien actually looked like Marshall Applewhite. So that was one of the main things that Hayden was like, this is what people are reporting, and I have this guy sitting in my office that says he's an alien, and, you know, are they telling the truth? There's the picture.
There,
yeah,
there it is, right there.
Similarity.
Yeah, and you know, there's tons of stuff in there. I mean, of course, the International UFO Bureau is famously where President Jimmy Carter filed his UFO report.
Right. Well, and, you know, as you were looking through some of the archives, Hayden was so good about reaching out to people. He wrote to people constantly.
Yes.
So whenever he heard about Jimmy Carter having a UFO sighting while on the campaign trail, he reached out to him. He sent him a note and he said, hey, would you mind filling out this UFO report form for me? And Jimmy Carter did and mailed it back to him. And so the original one was filed with the International UFO Bureau.
Wow. Wow. And yeah, you know, once again, correspondence from Isaac Asimov in there, correspondence from people like Wernher von Braun.
Yeah, know? That's this one right here.
Yeah.
On my wall.
Yeah. And just an amazing volume of things. Let's start getting into some of the cases that Hayden actually investigated real quick.
Okay. Which ones do you want to start with?
Let's start with the, I'm trying to remember the one that you were mentioning earlier. The first one.
We can go into Aurora.
Well, let's go into Aurora for a minute, because that is one that we both went to during MUFON. And, of course, we've had Daniel Alan Jones on numerous times talking about Aurora. And he had teamed up, Hayden had teamed up numerous times with Jim Mars from DFW. He was an investigative reporter. And he teamed up with him to go out and investigate Aurora numerous times.
So, yeah, that was back in the 70s, and Hayden's widow, Bonnie, was actually there for that. So we have a living witness to what kind of transpired at the time. And in the files, there's actually archive of the analysis carried out on the well water and the soil around there, I don't know if those have ever been published. So it would be interesting to put that out and be able to compare it to any more recent samples that have been taken from that area. And of course, to back up some for your listeners that may not be, you know, familiar with Aurora, it was back in 1897 whenever an airship was said to have crashed into a windmill, and the occupant was said to be not of this world, and they supposedly buried it there in the town cemetery. And when we went out there in July, you and I and Daniel and Melinda Leslie and others,
it was great.
They had actually moved this big rock that you see there in the picture, and they've put in like four little headstones now. So I don't know what they're doing at the site, but we were checking it for radiation and whatnot, and metal detecting and whatnot to see, you know, what we could pick up in the area.
And it is been a long storied case. And interestingly enough, you know, that is one of the first UFO flaps in the United States was the summer of 1897. There was one that I was literally about to text Daniel about earlier that I didn't know if he was even aware of in Beaumont in 1897, just months before this happened. So, yeah, there was a whole flap of airship sightings, and even the idea of a UFO flap, the fact that, you know, there's a series of sightings that happens in an area, that was quite literally the case with the Hartshorn flap.
Right. Out in Hartshorn?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hartshorn is, I mean, obviously it's continuing. People are still reporting things. The interesting thing about that, there was actually the wife of the postmaster. Her name was Altclair Morgan, and she had seen the first UFO just like a day or two prior to the outbreak there in 1965, which was July 31st through August 2nd. And I believe hers was like on July. Yeah, there we go. It was right there a day or two before. So she actually saw the first one in Hartshorn. Well, she knew exactly what was going on. And so she started taking reports from people there in town and holding sky watches. So people would sit around and watch, and they saw two types that they had called the red blinkers, and then there was a silver one that they called the leader. And I mean, she had hundreds of reports that she had logged. And then Hayden, of course, went out there and really kind of teamed up, and she had started writing for his interplanetary intelligence report, supplying information about what was going on there in Hartshorn. And, you know, I went out there a couple of years ago with a reporter and spoke to witnesses that are still seeing things and remember these sky watches. And there's something weird about Hartshorn. And I continue to be intrigued by it and look into it. But I think that it's fascinating that the entire 1965 flap really kicked off there in that small town.
Interesting. And you know, once again, the idea that it was dependable enough that they could have, you know, sky watching parties for it.
Yeah, we actually made contact with Altclair's granddaughter, and she still lives in that same old house. And so when we were out there, we had a sky watch with her, and she was so sweet. She had lawn chairs set up out there just like they used to, and of course had a couple of adult beverages for us. And it was just so nice sitting out there and just thinking, wow, this is what they were doing back in the 60s, you know, doing the same thing, watching the skies. And unfortunately, we didn't see anything that night, but it was just a neat experience to be there with the family and really, you know, taking it all in with the locals and their memories of Altclair and just everything that was transpiring back in the day.
Yeah. Now, as an investigator yourself, how frequent is it that flaps like this occur, where there are numerous sightings back to back, or sightings that occur over a span of time in an area?
Yeah, you know, I've been with MUFON for about 5-6 years now, and I have not seen anything declared a flap within that time. So, I mean, they're few and far between where there's just multiple sightings. I'd say probably the last quote-unquote flap would have been when the Chinese spy balloons were going over, if that's what you want to call them. But we knew, you know, something was going on during that time. And then, of course, you know, when Starlink was first started, everyone was seeing motherships and, you know, fleets coming through. So they would be false flaps that I've seen so far. So for something to still stand, there was something going on, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yeah. And, you know, there have been numerous cases over the last even decade. That have been massive, huge sightings, things like that. But when it comes to something like this flap that happened there in Oklahoma, it's on another scale.
Well, the 65 flap actually took place across like 7 states, I believe. There was an airplane that was flying over Kansas that saw some of the objects. There was people at a Air Force Base over in New Mexico that were reporting the objects. Tinker Air Force Base had caught several objects on their radar at the time. So it was across several states throughout those few days here in central U.S.
Wow. And, you know, once again, to know that this kind of stuff is out there, the archives of it, that he had covered this in real time as it happened to begin with, and that these archives are out there. Is there anywhere else that this data, I'm sure that there's copies of the Interplanetary Report kicking around somewhere at garage sales or in somebody else's private collection, you know, something like that, but do you know of anywhere else that all of this data has been gathered together in such a way on this specific flap of sightings?
I don't know. I think that as we see more and more archives getting actually digitized and put out there, we're going to be able to put a lot of this data together. Right now, there's so much lost knowledge that we've got to play catch up. I think that right now we are learning new stuff, but we've forgotten the old, and that's data that we could be building on. So it's important that we do get all of these historic documents together so that they're easily accessible to, I mean, just at your fingertips. And that's what I've just become so passionate about. I've got another archive that's going to be coming to me that I'm going to start working on after we finish up with the Hayden stuff.
Awesome.
But Hayden has just been incredible to be one to kick it off with. And like I said, it'll be added into Project Aquarius there with MUFON, which also has the Leonard Stringfield files, Ruppelt files, and I forget the other one that's on there as well. And they have all the newspaper archive, a drawings gallery. They have all the old, all the old MUFON journals are on there. So they have started building such a huge library of all these historic reports and writings from really great researchers from back in the day. I just think that it's incredible that we're going to be able to build on our understanding with what's coming to light now, you know?
Yeah. Because once again, it takes data. It takes mass amounts of data to research something like this. And that is something that we have said on this show time and time again. We are just getting to the point where science is even peeking its nose through the veil on some of these topics, much less, you know, fully investigating them. I mean, it quite literally took relabeling UFO to UAP for NASA to go, you know, we have been woefully disregarding our duty as scientists by not investigating something simply because of a name.
Well, and what's interesting, as you saw in the files, look how many things that we have from astronauts that wrote to Hayden about their belief in UFOs. And what's so funny is there's actually one in there from Edgar Mitchell.
Yep.
And it was before he believed in UFOs.
Yeah.
'Cause at the time he said, no, I don't believe in
it. Yeah. And even Wernher von Braun was like, no, you know, I don't know about this phenomena that you're talking about. Like, most of this has been explained. And with that in mind, you know, there were numerous, things like the Condon Report, all kinds of stuff in the history of UFO and government work and the military and government looking into UFOs. But Project Grudge was one that was really at the beginning of a lot of it. And to know that one of the things you had was an actual unredacted copy of Project Grudge, not just unredacted copy, but a copy with addendums pasted into it, and an actual reference, like used as a desk reference for somebody at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Pretty impressive. And going through that and seeing that, knowing that at least from our research thus far, we have not found a complete Project Grudge document that has everything, much less pasted in additions, changes,
yes,
to make
yes.
sure that things are up to date for the reference of it. And that's pretty incredible to come across.
One of the interesting things about Hayden, so to back up a little bit to tell a little bit about Hayden,
please.
He started the International UFO Bureau when he was 14, and he had written to the premier of Russia, Nikita Khrushchev, and was asking about photos of the dark side of the moon, and surprisingly, he wrote back to him and sent him pictures. So Hayden had the FBI come knock on his door, and his mother was like, you want to talk to my son? He's 14. What has he done? And they went and talked to him about, you know, what did you receive from, you know, the Soviet Union? And that kind of really lit the fire in Hayden. And in time, he ended up making contact with Wright-Patt, and they invited him to come out to the base, and he did. When he went out there, they showed him photos of different UFOs and said, we know you've seen these. You have not seen these. And if you come across these, don't talk about these. And he said, okay. And they sent him on a bus back to Oklahoma City, and there he was with his knowledge. So I believe that he continued his relationship with Wright-Patt. And somehow someone gave him this actual, you know, metal bound loose leaf copy of Project Grudge. And like you said, it has actual taped in addendums to it that, as far, you know, we were looking, I don't think they've ever been released. So there's going to be some more new information of what the military was actually thinking, that has never been released. But it's a lot of them are clarifiers or linking different cases to other cases in there. Just little notes that they wanted to put in with the individual case reports. So that'll be released to the public soon. I think that Hayden continued that relationship, and then he went on to work with the Condon Report, and we actually had some of the original UFO report forms from the Condon Reports, and they had different codes and whatnot if they thought something was promising or not, and we have those codes in there. I don't think that's not it. What is that?
No, this is more a Project Grudge. This is just wow. Okay. Look at
but yeah, the Condon report had those different codes and stuff that they used to see if they thought something was a promising case to actually use. Yeah. So he really kind of flew under the radar. He didn't make a huge name for himself, but I mean, he held conferences here in Oklahoma City, and he went on radio shows and had his own radio show that had over a million listeners. But most people don't know who he was, which is just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, just a fascinating, whenever you go through an archive like this, you really do get a fascinating snippet into the mind of somebody, into the way that somebody's mind works, into what cases they specifically found interesting. A prime example, once again, would be Marshall Applewhite. He had volumes of data on Heaven's Gate. So obviously,
they kept coming to him.
Well, and they kept coming to him.
And visiting with him and Brad Steiger. And they ended up writing Inside Heaven's Gate, which had a lot of the writings from Marshall Applewhite and a lot of his beliefs, which we listened to hours and hours of, which it's interesting with me. Yeah, there we go. Inside Heaven's Gate. It's kind of hard to find now, but
yeah.
It really gives you a good look into the investigator side and then what Marshall and his followers really believed. And I guess in the first release of the book, Marshall wasn't happy because the publishers had cut quite a bit of his gospel. And so they had him re-release it with some more of the information from what he had written. It's interesting. I know you have a religious background. I have, you know, a religious background, yep, being married to a pastor, and to kind of hear his take on things. He was the son of a pastor as well.
There he is with them.
That's in the International UFO Bureau with them sitting with, I believe that's Brad Steiger, recording their interview there.
And that's just it. Like you said, with this religious background, it's fascinating to see the way that somebody really delved into this case and the idea of it. Because, once again, to have an actual, and one of the things that we transferred was an actual copy of the intake video, Earth is recycling, you know, and to hear the words of Marshall Applewhite, to hear his teaching, to hear what he said. Once again, it's always been fascinating to me. It was something that happened during my lifetime, you know, when I was a young adult, shortly after I left the seminary, things like that. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I always identified with that quote, true believer aspect.
You know, when they first came out, they were going by him, which was human individual metamorphosis.
Yeah.
And he talked about, you know, kind of transforming as in like a butterfly being in a cocoon.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then they moved over to Heaven's Gate, where they talked about the level above human. And that's where they believed that they were going, was that next level above human.
Yeah.
So,
and
he weaves in a lot of Christianity.
Absolutely.
And a lot of New Age beliefs. Some of the things really aren't that far out there. And some of them we hear from, you know, different belief systems still today, just in different places.
Yeah.
But he's kind of, he'd put it all together. And it was sad, you know, how it ended, but they truly believed in what they were doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, even to explore the concept of, once again, how long the air quote cult lasted, which was a long time, long enough that, once again, ABC, or what, it was either ABC or CBS, did a made for TV movie about them at one point called The Other Two. You know, I believe that was the name of it. I may be wrong, but yeah, like they did a whole made for TV movie about tea and dough and the teaching O&P. That they had about.
All kinds of stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like it was fascinating enough that 1982 television caught a hold of it for a made for TV movie, you know. So it was apparently a fascinating doctrine and something that they didn't hide or squirrel away or anything like that. They didn't ask people to give them everything that they had upon entering. It was pretty fascinating. And then just to give a little bit here, here is a little bit of the intake video.
Pretty bold in terms of religion, in terms of anybody's intelligent thinking. To most people who would consider themselves intelligent beings, they'd say, well, that's absurd. What's all this doomsday stuff? What's all this prophetic stuff? You know, intelligent human beings should realize that everything has their cycle. They have their season. They have their beginning. They have their end. They have cycles. We're not saying that planet Earth is coming to an end. We're saying that planet Earth is about to be refurbished, spaded under, and have another chance to serve as a garden for another human civilization.
Interesting. Interesting stuff once again to hear from Marshall Applewhite himself. And when we watched all of that, the predominant thing that I got, and this is not about Marshall's teaching or anything like that. Remember, folks, this was 1997. This was the infancy, not the beginnings of the internet, all right? Because the internet began in like 1978, like back in the day when you could like put your phone on a receiver for your computer and dial into a bulletin board system, all right? Like 1982, things like that, the internet existed. That's how war games happened, all right? But the beginnings of the internet as we know it, where it was an online shopping platform, it was where you went to get news, it was where you went to find things, it was where you went for chat rooms and bulletin board systems and things like that. And the one thing that kept being echoed in all of these news reports from sociologists, from experts, everything was these lonely people on the internet who have no friends other than on the internet. Marshall Applewhite and Heaven's Gate used the internet and their website to spread their message, to bring people in, and people are no longer able. This was 1997. Sociologists were saying people are not able to take the information on the internet and disseminate fact from fiction. This was 1997. We were having the exact same problems with the internet that we are having now, Mindy. You know, where quite literally, if you post a picture and don't give proper data on it, you could convince anybody of what's in that picture, you know? So yeah, it was interesting to see that here we are almost 30 years later dealing with the technology, and we're having the exact same hurdle with the technology. We're having the exact same issue when it comes to this community, when it comes to, and I'll play the video that I normally play at this point, that I recorded right here in my backyard, you know, where it's like, if I was to post this video anywhere on the internet with no information other than, hey, I recorded this flashing colored orb in my backyard last night floating across the sky, I could probably get a whole lot of responses from people about it. Now, if I give the data with that and explain how high it was, what time it was, everything else, you could probably figure out that that is the Dog Star Sirius unfocused in a telescope with just the natural motion of the Earth zoomed in through a telescope being exaggerated as motion moving pretty rapidly across the screen. But without data, we don't have that. You know, if it's happening in a vacuum, if that information is happening in a vacuum, we don't get that. And it's very much the same way when it comes to how people process things on the internet, how people were drawn in to the message of Heaven's Gate. And people ask all the time, you know, like, how does a logical person, because like they made their money making websites for people. They were SEO masters, like before SEO as we know it exists. You know, like they were great at that kind of stuff. So that's how they made their money. They were a step forward in the new world of the internet. So it's interesting to see that, and interesting to see that even investigation wise, things like that, we are still faced with the same hurdles right now. Right now, we still have the same information bias as a society when we find information on the internet. Right now, that we had in 1997, almost 30 years ago.
I think it's worse now, because now we have AI, you know, and you see these photos. Wow, that's incredible. You know, trying to differentiate between what's AI generated. Well, and it's not that great yet, but we're getting there, because anytime that there's a picture of a person, you know, they have seven fingers. Two mouths, or they're conjoined or something, but it's going to get to where it's indistinguishable from reality. And I mean, it's darn good already.
Oh yeah.
But, yeah. There was a whole show that we watched that we had an archive that was talking about the usage of the internet to put this information out there. And just the different belief systems, if people were able to catch on, and look how many cults and different belief systems are out there now.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know, because some things that when I first started in investigating UFO encounters, I thought, that's kind of silly. But then you hear it over and over and over again from different experiencers, and you're like, well, maybe it's not that silly. You know, I would never discount someone completely, but there's some things that you just have personal bias and you think, well, that's not likely. And you have to maintain some semblance of, you know, straight thinking. So
yes, yes. And I've said, I know you have had your experience, not only with NDE, but with the divine. I have had mine with the divine and with shadow people, things like that. I will never discount anybody's experience. However, there was a situation recently where I heard an experiencer start talking about their experience, and then start expanding on their experience and how they had contact with, you know, 15 different species, and these things happen to them about 15, 20 nights a month, you know, things. And I'm not doubting anybody. But immediately to me, that's not red flags. That's flares in the sky, you know, like, hey, wait a minute. There's a person on social media who I don't see post much anymore, but they used to post pretty regularly out of San Antonio. Like, I see these in my backyard, like 3-4 nights a week, you know? And it's like, at that point, why aren't you selling tickets?
Yeah.
Because it's no longer, you know, unidentifiable. I would say, I wouldn't say it's an anomaly at that point. It's a pretty known quantitative. If you can just like hop out 3-4 nights a week and take pictures of them or take video in your backyard, that is no longer anomalous. That's a regular occurrence, you know? And you have to consider that. You have to be willing to consider that research wise, you know. Unfortunately, you do have to let that be a possibility. Even though it may, and that's something that research wise, you have to be ready for, you know, I think
that's why it's so important with like what I do with director of training with MUFON.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that our investigators can rule out what's able to be ruled out. We have such technology now, it within an hour or two, you can do a full workup and check everything that we're able to check within the night sky. Now, this isn't going to include military things, you know, but regular aircraft and meteors and placements of the stars and planets and we can check all of those things and rule out, you know, satellites that are going over. And if there is someone that's having a regular occurrence like that, normally it is satellites that are being misidentified. And if we're able to pinpoint that, then we can show them, hey, next time pull up this app and look and see if that's lining up with what you're seeing. And so we're able to cut down on the false positives and really get it down to the real unexplained sightings. And that's been pretty, I used to get pretty upset with Project Blue Book, how they would, you know, explain everything away until I became a researcher and an investigator.
Yeah.
And I started realizing, okay, a lot of these really are misidentifications, and I can understand where the frustration is, because there is something going on that we cannot explain, but a lot of things are explainable, and we have to really be open-minded to those that we can't explain, but within reason.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. You know, that is actively a lot of the effort that we have at Curious Research, is the idea of being able to bring this kind of research to science. And what we have to be willing to do is say, okay, what we have is data. We need to start looking at it all as data until we get to a point that we can call that data evidence, you know, because evidence should be held to a different standard. Evidence should be, as we say on the show regularly, something that exonerates you in a court of law. Like, you should have that kind of confidence when you say, we have evidence, you know?
Yeah. Well, and again, on the MUFON side, I know your book that you just put out is wonderful for people to go out and be able to document what they're seeing. On MUFON side, we're putting a big push towards getting out in the field and collecting the evidence. There you go. Your field observation and encounter log.
and that's the thing, though, is that it starts with observation. Like, that is the beginning of the science. As soon as you have seen something, you are now the scientist. Like, your observation begins the scientific process, people. So
it does. That's with the intake of the report. And then people like me or other field investigators, we can go out and collect this evidence, send it off to our lab, and get hard science behind it that actually helps prove the phenomena. And with the hard science, when people say, oh, I saw this, I saw that. Well, let's put that to the scientific test. Let's run the analysis on it and see if we can back that up. And that's where we're going to, you know, really start making some good breakthroughs.
Well, and you know, that is also where things inside of red circles start being explained sometimes, Mindy. And that can be hurtful to people. You know, that can be hurtful to a paradigm of somebody's belief. And I get that. I understand that. But we have to remember that just because the picture or the video that we took or the audio that recording that we have ends up being explained does not mean that we have not contributed to the science of the cause. The science of the cause is once again, honing things down to the point of unexplained, honing it down to the point of phenomenon, that 3 to 5 percentile range. So the more data that we have of known quantitatives, the faster that happens for the rest of them. So just because what you brought to the table has been explained in the realm of known quantitative, that only expands the realm of known quantitative. So you've still added to the scientific data set hugely.
And case in point would be the Starlinks. I go back to that because when they were first being launched, we had so many different reports. Some people saw a mothership. It was a long oval, one big solid bar light. Some people saw a fleet and they saw dot, 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 dot in the sky. Some people said, I saw one light go over. A minute later, another one went over in the same direction. So you're getting all these different reports, but it's from the same source. And then when Falcon 9 started launching and returning to the launch pad, then we had the separation of the first and second stage, and we had the spirals.
That the first squids and the spirals.
Went right over Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So my phone was lit up that night with all these fantastic. I'm like, oh my gosh, is this another mass sighting? But took an hour or two to start looking through what's going on here. And it was the launch of that first Falcon 9 with the separation stage. Yep. And it created that spiral. So we have all these different explanations for one single phenomenon. And we wouldn't have understood that if we didn't have the observations from all of the witnesses reporting to be able to understand this is all part of the same thing and it's all explainable. Yeah. So it does. It all contributes to our understanding. And I hope people really take that to heart.
Well, and it's important. And with that comes the importance and the onus upon people like yourself, Mindy, who have possession of archives like this, to digitize them, to get them digitized, to make sure that the research, because the metric research done by someone like a Hayden Hughes, the metric research done by somebody like a Jim Mars, is just vast. It's vast. You and it is irreplaceable. Irreplaceable when it comes to hypothesis, theorem, when it comes to the case files that they have, and even the marriage of those case files with things like MUFON, where once again, as MUFON says all the time, if it happened 30 years ago, let us know. Your report of your event 30 years ago, our guest in the next segment, Archbishop James Cloud, and I believe he is doctor also, if I'm not mistaken, but Archbishop James Cloud, he reported his incident from when he was a early child, like 9-10 years old, I believe, just this last year and a half, 2 years to MUFON, you know, but your report 20 years later may confirm three other reports.
That's it.
That were given 20 years ago, the night of or the night after.
You know, it's funny. My mother, with me growing up, my mom was never into UFOs or anything like that. But she had always told me that her and my aunt had seen a UFO hovering at treetop level right outside of my grandmother's house.
Wow.
And she had told me, oh, it was my sophomore year of high school, and we were out there on my grandpa's old Ford, and we saw it. You know, it came down, it was huge, and it was silent, and it was hovering there, and it had yellow and red and blue flashing lights. Well, fast forward to a couple of years ago, I start finding out about the 1965 flap, and lo and behold, it was the summer of mom's sophomore year when everybody was reporting this. So my mother had actually seen one of the UFOs during that huge flap that happened over the city, and I had no idea that her sighting was part of one of these huge historic events.
Wow.
You know, so just knowing and having that confirmation, people should always report, because we can still gather so much information. My big report of the schoolyard encounters, what set off this whole, you know, journey into getting the Hayden Hughes reports and all of his files. And now all of the information that we'll be able to make available to the public, we haven't even scratched the surface today. You know that. And I know that we'll be speaking about this more in depth in the future, because all we really talked about was Aurora and Heaven's Gate. And I mean,
there's
what
tons.
We got it's 25 megabytes, gigabytes of data.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's be very clear. We've got almost 20 gigs of documents. It's just a massive amount. It's a massive amount. So yeah, like I've been working since I got back, cleaning things up and trying to write a script to watermark all of these things individually, so that I don't have to go through and do it by hand. All kinds of fun stuff. And even working on the website, things like that, for me, once again, it's a passion project because I am passionate about research and about sharing research and about the idea that, once again, it cannot happen in a vacuum. By definition, you've got to have a ride or die research buddy, something, you know.
Well, like you and Chris, you're such a godsend. You really are.
Thank you.
With your knowledge and IT capabilities and being able to connect with people like myself that have these kind of resources here, that just that partnership, we would not be able to put it out to the public on the scale we are going towards without you. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
I mean, really, from the bottom of my heart, you know, I just adore you. And
same,
I hope
same.
That people will really look at reaching out to you if they have archives similar, even if they're small archives.
Yeah.
All of this data that we can put together for researchers to add to our collective knowledge of this phenomena, it all helps.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, I was more than happy to help out with Project Aquarius with things like this to be able to get this information culled together and brought together and under roofs where it's accessible to people, where it's no longer hidden away in a basement, that kind of stuff. You know, somebody was asking me not too long ago, how does stuff like this just vanish? And it's like, you know, because it doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. It's like, how did Dad's, you know, $500,000 baseball card collection vanish? Because when he died, Mom was like, oh my God, I can finally get rid of these things. Ah, and she doesn't care about them. She doesn't know what they are. They're just baseball cards, man. I at one point, I'm sure, had tons of toys that whenever I left, my mom just stopped. Nope. You know, things like that. So yeah, it happens rapidly. And we as humanity lose that knowledge rapidly if it's not shared, if it's not kept around, you know. So the idea of archiving these, bringing these archives together, putting them together, it's fantastic. It's great. So I love what you guys at MUFON are doing with Project Aquarius. And when you asked if I would help with the Hayden Hughes archive, I could not resist. So thank you for the opportunity. It's been great. And I can't wait
Chris.
To do great, great things with it. It's amazing. It's fantastic research, and it's going to be great to be able to share it with the world. Where can everybody go to A, find out more about Project Aquarius? B, where can they go to find out about you and contact you if they have a case in Oklahoma or anything like that, or more archive information to add to the Hayden Hughes archive? And where can they go to find out more about Hayden Hughes?
My goodness, we've got a lot going on. So Project Aquarius is through MUFON, and you can go to projectaquarius.mufon.com, and you do not have to be a MUFON member.
Nope.
The newspaper archive is open to the public. It's free access. If you'd like access to the other rooms with the specific researchers and their archives, then it's a $50 a year library card. Not bad for the amount of information.
Absolutely.
That's in there. To get a hold of me, they can go to mindytotfest.com, and I've got some of the information about Hayden on there. Like I said, we'll probably be moving some of that over to the new website, which will be haydenhughes.com. which, Chris, you've graciously got up now. It's for the Hayden Hughes UFO Research Center, and we will start adding some of this information on there for public access.
It's exciting. It's going to be great. Thank you so much for everything, as always, Mindy, for coming on the show, for sharing your wealth of knowledge about not only Hayden Hughes, but MUFON and research in general. So always great chatting with you. Always great having you on the show.
You too, Chris. Take care.
Absolutely. We'll be in touch soon with links, all that kind of good stuff.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Take care. While you are online checking out everything from Mindy Topfist, everybody at mindytopfist.com, as well as Hayden Hughes at haydenhughes.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can comment, share. That is where you can find all of the episodes, as well as our store that carries all of the books, videos, and classes from our guests, good people such as Mindy herself. It's where you can also get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are out in the field Sasquatching, if you are out in the field doing paranormal research, if you are out in the field taking witness statements from UFO witnesses, stop on by and check that out, everybody. It is available on Amazon. When we come back from this quick break, we will be joined by our good friend Archbishop James Cloud. We will be talking about the topic of signs of the times, end time revelation, prophecies, things like that. We will be getting into that right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hymn Science. Christopher Lynch is the founder of True Hymn Science here in Austin, Texas. He is an amazing, amazing wizard when it comes to the world of CBD and CBD-related products. He uses a spigyric process. That is a combustible process used by alchemists that uses every part of a plant, then takes the leavings, reuses it, takes the leavings of that and combusts it all the way down to nothing, using everything to create an amazing terpene profile, an amazing product. Stop on by and check him out. TrueHymnScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free 50 milligram edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Archbishop James Cloud. He is an exorcist in the Order of St. Michael the Archangel. We have him on regularly talking about the world of demonology. I look forward to yet another banned episode in the Middle East with you tonight. Good Father, welcome back to the show. Archbishop James Cloud, our guest tonight, we are talking about signs of the times, end time prophecy, things like that. This is, of course, something near and dear to my heart. as a student of the Bible, as somebody who spent his early life looking to become a Catholic seminarian, became a Catholic seminarian. But more interestingly than that is the idea of where these ideas come from and where these ideas lead to, Archbishop, and specifically when it comes to the prophecies. And I use that word in a capital sense. I don't use it in a lowercase sense because to me, people like Nostradamus, let's get this very clear at the beginning of this show, folks. Nostradamus is not a prophet. I hate to tell you, he may be a seer. He may be a clairvoyant. What have you, but he is not a prophet. Prophets offer a way out. You cannot say that any better. Prophets offer a way out. So if there's no way out, if this isn't a moral lesson, do this or else this will happen, then it's not a prophet. You're talking about a seer. So let's get that very clear up front before we get into biblical prophecy and the idea of apocalyptic prophecy, the idea of prophecies of the end of time as we know it. So where do these really begin in biblical tradition, Archbishop? Where do these, I guess, apocalyptic doctrines start from in the Bible?
Well, it starts really in the Old Testament from the books of Daniel and Ezekiel. You got the Gog-Magog War prophesied to happen near the end. You have the Psalm 83 war, which could be happening currently in the Middle East. You have, of course, the book of Revelation. You also have 2 Thessalonians, 1 Corinthians, that speaks about at the time of the end what the temperature, shall we say, of people will be like, you know, unloving, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, et cetera, et cetera. That pretty much marks the current world. As when you look at that passage of scripture, I mean, it's right there. Then, of course, you have in Revelation, you know, John the Apostle saw all of that was to happen. God was basically saying, well, this will happen regardless of timing, if people change their ways or whatnot, because at some point people will stop changing their ways and will stop leaning on God and lean on themselves for such things. And so you have in the book of Revelation or the book of the Apocalypse, it's called both, but you have, I mean, huge archetypes like the Mark of the Beast. You have a world government, and the government will basically be a socialist dictatorship, which is interesting to note that most of the world seems to be moving towards socialism.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the election in the United States. You got a choice there.
Well, I think it's very important to note at that point also, Archbishop, the fact that it is a perceived socialism. It is a deception upon humanity. It's not an actual socialism that's there for the betterment of mankind that gets taken advantage of by the other side, by the Antichrist. It's set up for the Antichrist, like from the get go. It's not something that's like, you know, let's do this for the best of humanity, and then it gets corrupted. It is of corruption. So that's very important to state that, like, what you're seeing, at least according to deep biblical tradition, is according to how it's supposed to be. It's not going to be made for the betterment of mankind and then corrupted.
Yeah, correct. No, the upcoming world government will be for the benefit of one man, the Antichrist, and his false prophet. So in order to impose this mark of the beast, this digital currency, on the entirety of humanity for identity, for medical records for you name it. And most importantly, you can't buy or sell without this mark, which works perfectly for a digital currency. If they don't like what you're doing, they simply shut off your money flow.
Yeah.
It's that easy. It's programmable central bank digital currency is really what it has. It boils down to. And this is all of these things. If it was just one of these things popping up, you know, you could say, well, yeah, that's probably a foundational thing. It'll be developed years down the road and become whatever. But you have world governance. You can look up the World Economic Forum, look up what the UN is trying to put out as far as world governance, I should say. And they're backing the whole universal digital ID for all world citizens to verify who they are. And, you know, and if a person didn't have any biblical background or a biblical insight on this stuff, it sounds really good. You know, my money will be secure. It'll be a verified ID. It'll cut down on fraud and all this. And hey, who doesn't want peace in the world and blah, blah, blah. Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have even said on this show, Archbishop, the fact of, you know, be prepared for a digital wallet. Be prepared for it. I mean, there's a major crisis going on with the dollar right now. I literally posted articles about it this morning. It's Monday, folks, just so you know. Second guest is always pre-recorded. So, but yeah, the fact is there are already these concepts being put into place. And I've said it before on the show, get ready for a digital wallet that is not only your passport, and your ID, but it will also be possibly your means of voting. Which will all be encrypted with blockchain. And don't get me wrong, I have traded crypto. I have generated crypto through mining and helped build the blockchain, all right? So I have full faith in blockchain technology as far as keeping things safe, keeping things encrypted, that kind of stuff. Like, yes, you could probably do your voting from a blockchain phone and absolutely, like, not have to miss work to go vote. However, could that also be used as a means of one world push technology? Darn tootin', it could be.
Yep, absolutely. You know, we're sacrificing a lot of our freedoms in across the globe, really, for convenience. You know, I believe it was Ben Franklin that said, a person that gives up freedom for safety and security deserves neither.
Yeah.
You know,
and, you know, you do have to be concerned about that. And you do, you know, that kind of brings us to kind of the entire quandary of end time prophecy to begin with. And once again, loops us right back to that capital P term prophecy, the idea of free will. The idea of free will being exercised by humanity and the fact of even though there is a divine plan and even though we take part in that divine plan, we do not alter said divine plan.
Correct.
And, you know, we tend to shoot the prophets, Padre. We tend to tell them, you know, like, oh, yeah, great. You got swallowed by a whale and spit up on our shores to come tell us a message. All right, man, get out of here. You know, yeah. And that's what tends to happen to the prophets of old is you, when you read their stories, they were ignored most of the time. Their warnings were not heeded. But once again, they were warnings. It wasn't just a soothsaying of doom. It was, hey, man, fix and mend your ways or else this will occur and be incurred.
Yep. And Revelation is no different. You know, we have the free will to either accept the plan of salvation because, you know, God is saying these events are going to happen regardless of what we want or anything else. So you have the choice. You can either accept Christ as a savior, or you can accept him as judge. And at the end, you know, we have that free will choice. We can, in the Bible guarantees we're going to escape God's judgment if we're aligned with Christ. You could go to the bank on that one. That's a foundational promise that we're given in the scriptures to keep us out from the time of trial, to keep us from. Now, that could get into ideas of the rapture or whatnot. And there's a load of, you know, opinions on that, too. But that is the escape route, because God's already set in motion a lot of these things, and we don't have the time to play around much anymore. That's the thing. But I think a lot of churches today, they're playing around. They're playing church. They're not being the church. You know, they're like, even when I was a parish priest and I would warn people about what was coming, you know, to get their lives right and to, hey, you got, go to confession, go do what you need to do to get your life right, because it's coming. I was called schizophrenic. I was called mentally ill. I was even usurped in my parish.
Oh, wow.
And the Anglican church I was the priest of at the time, the vestry, which is the voting board, took the entire church out from under me.
Oh, wow.
And my bishop, and went with another jurisdiction. Just so that they could do their own thing. Also, make money, you know, because I was always about, let's live for Christ. You know, let's focus on the scriptures. Let's see what the Bible say. Be a good Berean. You know, you are looking at the scriptures and divining rightly with the Holy Spirit. And they wanted nothing of it. And God forbid I talked about sin, you know, because then, oh, well, now you're, everyone's getting butt hurt, you know. Oh, you're talking about my favorite activity.
Yeah.
Well, it's in the scriptures that that's not God's favorite activity, and you will answer for that activity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, even once you start looking at, I guess really the only way to put that, Father, is interpretation. Once you put those things to interpretation, interpretations swing and vary widely. You know, if you put it down to hard fact of what is on the page, and that is immutable and does not change and is not bound for interpretation, then that gives you a different angle of argument from it. You know, absolutely. And it takes people of open minds and open hearts on both sides to be able to have that bridging, even right now. Like, you know fully that, I mean, we've had more than one conversation. There are some things that I fully disagree on, but I'm perfectly willing to have the conversation about it. You know, because we've got to be willing to have the conversation about it. We've got to be willing to have the conversation, sadly, folks, about the end of time and about the fact of, you know, whether or not I still practice Catholicism a couple few days a week within the bounds of a church doesn't mean that I don't follow the modicum of tempus fugit memento mori from the Knights of Columbus, and the idea of time flies, remember death. You know, what will you be remembered for? How have you changed the world? How have you put the world to change? That is our charge as Christian men, period, is to ripple the waters around us and make sure that as we leave, that the world is changed in some way. So how are we remembered, you know? And even whenever you're looking at revelatory biblical references, we have to consider, how are we changed by that? How are we catalyzed by these messages? And when you, yeah, when you start looking at, the prophecies of Megiddo and the Battle of Megiddo, it can be really hard not to see that being echoed in the Middle East right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard. And, you know, the Battle of Armageddon, you know, that goes back to the Hebrew Har Megiddo, which is the mountain of Megiddo.
Yep.
The big valley, the big plains at the base of that mountain is where it's prophesied that the world's armies will gather. And then they'll move to the Valley of Jehoshaphat to hit Jerusalem. And once Jerusalem has three quarters of Jerusalem is destroyed, that's when Christ comes back, sets his foot on the Mount of Olives, and a great earthquake occurs around the globe that all the islands disappears, mountains fall down flat. The earthquake is so great, and he slaughters the world army. And it says the blood will flow as high as the horse's bridle. So, you know, it's that piece especially isn't metaphor. We see, and the Valley of Megiddo has been a site of wars for thousands of years.
Yep.
In that area. You know, main trading vein that went through there. You had, I think even the Silk Empire went through there and then up through Petra and out, you know, through Jordan. Yeah, you know, all of these things, it's for me personally, you know, I'm going to speak for James, you know,
sure.
I see all of these things occurring at the same time, and they're increasing in speed and force. Yeah. And the world governments are saying we need a world government. We need a UN. That was one thing that the UN did say recently on a news article. The UN wants to have a global digital currency like security council so that the G20 nations can oversee a global digital currency and they all can work on one central bank digital currency, basically one ring to rule them all. You know, Lord of the Rings reference there. And truly, that is the foundation of the mark of the beast. You know, because the mark of the 7-year tribulation, the first 3.5 years is the phase-in period. Once what begins that is they'll sign a 7-year peace deal with Israel and these other Arab nations around them, and then that's the day. The tribulation period starts, the 7 years.
Yeah.
It's a countdown.
Yeah. And what I've just popped up on screen, folks, my brother and I had a huge conversation about this on the way to Texas UFOCon. And I used to edit for NPR. And I've heard the Lucis Trust commercials and things like that. And it never really dawned on me, never really looked it up, but we started getting into it about Lucis Trust. And the interesting thing is knowing that the Lucis Trust has the support of the United Nations. Now, some of you may be like, Chris, what is this Lucis Trust that you're talking about? Here's their website. The Lucis Trust is dedicated to the establishment of a new and better way of life for everyone in the world. Based on the fulfillment of the divine plan for humanity, its educational activities promote recognition and practice of the spiritual principles and values upon which a stable and independent world society may be based. The esoteric philosophy of its founder, Alice Bailey, informs its activities, which are offered freely throughout the world in 8 languages. Once you start digging into things and start seeing things, you start seeing messages about like the confusion of Lucifer, things like that. And it's really interesting to see where they start going into Lucifer, the light bearer and that kind of stuff. Very, very much, the same thing that's talked about in the works of mainly P. Hall, things like that. You know, which is, of course, a lot of the reasons why the Catholic Church has always said, like, you can't be a Catholic and be a Mason because, well, they're talking about the Luciferian knowledge system and the idea of Lucifer, the light bearer and, you know, things like that. So But that is the loosest trust. And it's interesting to see that once again, here is this religious organization that has the support of the UN as a means by which to get a global spirituality going.
Yeah. And ultimately it'll be the deification of man, the apotheosis of man. That's the ultimate, thing that will start. I mean, you already see that, you know, man is basically God. Man is the master and commander of their own destiny. Mm. And they don't need a divine figure to give them any form of meaning or anything else. Well, why do you think atheism, even agnosticism to a degree, evolution, all of these other things show and point to a natural progression of human. I mean, and you look at the post-humanism things that are taken off right now. Is his name? Noah. He's second in command of the World Economic Forum. Mm. I know Noah, but I can't.
That's okay.
His name is. But Noah Harari, I think, is his name. And he totally lambasts God, Christ, religion, and he says man is God.
Yuval Noah.
Yeah, his middle
name is Yuval Noah Harari.
Yeah. Yeah. And you take a look at some of his books and the interviews he's given, and that man is the spitting image of what the Antichrist will be saying. And I don't know if he is. I'm not saying he is by any means, but his mentality and his words that's backed up the World Economic Forum and by the UN is exactly what blasphemies that the Bible talks about when it talks about the man of sin exalting himself above all other gods, because it's really about man becoming God. And in post-humanism, you're talking about cyborgs, AI implantations. You're talking about enhancements to the human body. And
especially once you get it. And, you know, we've definitely had Gray Scott on the show. He's a futurist. We've had Zoltan Istvan on the show before, back in the Dudes and Beer days, talking about just the world of transhumanism, what you're talking about, the coming singularity, the idea that eventually there will be no barrier between humanity and machine. And it will go beyond arm implants, things like that. That's what we're doing right now. Don't get me wrong, but the idea that wetware will soon exist, things beyond the idea of just the neural implant for seizures and that kind of stuff. Even the technology that's been seen with MIT coming out of that. Where they did a recent study with a bunch of people that had the cerebral implant in the back of their head for control of seizures, and decided to study the way that their brain was able to work and what kind of information they could pull from that. So while under an MRI and receiving data from this, they had them listen to a Pink Floyd song. And then 2 weeks later, had each person in the study come back, go back into the MRI, and this time they hit record and had them think about the Pink Floyd song, and they were able to reconstruct it.
Wow.
From these people's individual thoughts, they were able to reconstruct the actual song, and it sounds creepy as hell. It's wild. But even just the fact of this was something that they were repeatedly able to do. That is a new realm of technology for brain-computer interface.
Absolutely. And I've heard of studies that they've been doing. I'm not sure if it was MIT or someone else, but being able to influence the mood and thought patterns through interface like a chip.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always wondered why when the Bible says, once you take the mark of the beast in your right hand or forehead, you're damned. There's no more chance of salvation after that. Well, if your mind is being manipulated by an implant, you're not going to even care. I heard brain scientist say one time on an interview that they were actually able to knock out through an implant a person's connection with God so that they didn't care about God or think about God or anything like that. Now, I'm not sure where that was, because I heard the scientist yapping about it, and he was all proud, and isn't this wonderful? And I'm just thinking, wow, if that's not part of the mark of the beast, I don't know what is.
And that's really interesting. I mean, we talk a lot about targeting technologies, things like that on this show. And just the idea that, yes, you could absolutely use an implant. You could absolutely use a regular message, something like that, to break somebody's connection to the divine. There's a great study that we've been showing a lot on the show that actually came out during COVID, from the National Institute of Health, showing that even negative news cycles actively cause bruising damage to the hippocampus, which is the soft velvety glove that protects your amygdala, the little almond shaped, part of your brain that is the reticent reptilian brain, the home of fight or flight panic mechanisms, you know, that kept us alive for millennia. So when you damage that gentle hippocampus, you're basically leaving somebody exposed to fight or flight mechanism all the time. And the idea that even a negative news cycle can beat up the hippocampus so much that it leaves you in that state. That in and of itself is a means of control. That in and of itself is a means of breaking down that barrier and even bringing some people to the point of disbelief in the divine. The fact that there ain't no God out there. Look at the horrible things happening in the world.
Yeah. And that doesn't shock me at all that they would look at that because from just a control perspective, a fearful population is more controllable because they can offer a solution that population might not have considered before, but now everyone's so scared and nervous and anxious about what's going on. Now, they have the solution to this. It'll solve a bunch of stuff. You know, the immigrants, the world economic issues, identity fraud and identity theft, and it's terrible. And as they push, people are like, yeah, give me that chip so I can be more secure. I feel insecure right now. Give me something to make me feel more comfortable and safe. Even though they're signing away their rights to freedom.
And it is interesting I think, and I've said it for years on the previous show and on this one, we are rife for this as a people right now in America. We are so entirely divided. We are so entirely upheaved with not only our own communities, our own families, but ourselves, our beliefs, our core beliefs as individuals. As people, and you add that 2 years of lockdown and panic stricken modes and everything else to that, it doesn't help things. It doesn't help things. And when you start seeing things, folks, red heifer ceremonies getting ready to start happening. You know, here it is from Al Jazeera. What do Texas red heifers have to do with Al-Aqsa or Al-Aqsa and a Jewish temple? The idea that, there is a, quote, red heifer ceremony that is supposed to take place, according to Jewish tradition, before these things happen, before these things occur. So when you start seeing things like that in the news, and you may be of religious fervor, you may be of deep-seated religious belief, you marry that headline with all these other things and with the panic, and it can be hard not to think that rapture is directly around the corner, Father. It can be hard not to believe that, you know?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is Hamas said they did the October 7th attack to actually thwart the red heifers being sacrificed. They actually came out with a news article on that. You could probably search that
up. I will. I
admitted it. Yeah. Because Israel was getting ready to do the red heifer sacrifice. I think it was going to be in April around Passover or whatnot. And so Hamas jumped the attack plan by Hezbollah and Iran and went in by themselves because they wanted to stop the red heifer sacrifice. So even the Muslims believe heavily in the red heifer sacrifice.
Wow. So, yes.
That's another angle that a person can look at this with.
Well, and you know, another one of those quote from Matthew signs of the time, you know, that is quite literally the theme for this episode is the signs of the time as we talk about in the Bible. So when you get into that and when you start looking at the actual things that are there, you know, the Great Tribulation, beginning of calamities, things like that. Like, once again, I could see how numerous times over, and I've been pretty fascinated for years and getting ready to do a couple of episodes on various cults, not only in America, but across the globe, you know, Moonies, things like that. And, for generations, Father, there have been cultures out there, different religious beliefs out there, millennial beliefs. There were huge ones at the millennium, that it was all going to end. And one of them is near and dear to my heart, the Heaven's Gate, you know, yeah. and that even David Koresh, where it's like he did some bad things. Don't get me wrong. He did some horrible, horrible things. Not so much Marshall Applewhite, but David Koresh, definitely, you know. But his believers is what you have to look at. And the fact of their belief, even now, there are survivors from Waco, Archbishop, that are like, these times are coming. And we'll see if David was right that he's the second coming. We're going to find out pretty rapidly, y'all. You know, and that's where they come down on it is sure. These things were horrible. They were bad. I'm not saying that they were good, but we're going to find out in real quick order whether or not what David said was right. And they're looking for him to be right. You know, and when you like, I have never held in my heart that the people with Heaven's Gate, by their belief, did anything wrong, Archbishop. They followed their belief to the core and to the hilt. And I can't fault them any more than you can, you know, fault the Hebrews that were fighting the war that led to what we now know as Hanukkah, you know, and that tradition, things like that. These are deep seated belief that people are willing to die for, you know, and whether you want to call that a cult or not, you know, whether you want to call Christianity a cult or not, because there were definitely cults even within Christianity like that. The whole Vatican I thing started because of Arianism, which was a cult within Christianity, you know? These traditions and these adjunct traditions of teaching have been around for a long, long time, since just about the beginning of organized religion as we know it, prophecies of the end, things like that. So the idea that these are carried through to modern day culture, and especially when it comes to, once again, the idea of the red heifer sacrifice, which may very well be getting ready to go on. And it's something that we need to consider. Is it the fact that, you know, there is a sect of Judaism out there preparing for this ceremony that, by all accounts and by all traditions, will lead to the end?
Yep, it will. But you know what? Everything we're seeing right now are across the globe. I mean, you look at the signs that Jesus told his disciples to look out for. Wars and rumors of war. You know, the skeptic would say, oh, we've always had wars and, you know, rumors that there's going to be a war and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's true. Then you have the magnitude and frequency of earthquakes around the globe will increase.
Yep.
Well, if that was by itself, I'd say, yeah, maybe, you know, the Earth is just going through a cycle of some sort. Yeah. Then you have the rampant plagues, the diseases that are going around the globe now, all over the place. Then you have in the epistles that Paul said that the love of many will grow cold. They'll be heartless, thankless, rebellious, disobedient to their parents, etc., etc., etc. When you read that passage, it like I said earlier, it's exactly what the Bible said it would be.
Yeah.
And so everything is happening all at once, like Christ said it would, because that was Christ's warning to his apostles, because they were curious. Hey, what's the sign of the time and, you know, sign of the end? And he went through all of these things, and we've always had one or two of those things happen. But he said, when you see all of these things coming to pass at once, the end is near. Keep your candles trimmed, you know, be on your knees. Look for the second coming, because when Christ comes back, it'll be no mistake as to who Christ is. First time he came as the Lamb, second time he comes as King. And so people got to be aware about what's actually coming down the pipe.
Yeah.
Because you'll have tons of people, even ministers, will say, oh, it's no big deal. These things happen all the time. It's just blah, blah, blah. You know, and for those of us that study the scriptures, know the scriptures, and look at all of these things, to us, we're sitting back going, you know, raising the alarm bell. It's coming, folks. It's coming. Because we've never seen the intensity and frequency that we're seeing now. And, you know, and a lot of people are actually coming back to faith because there's a general sense that something's coming. You know, a lot of people, I've talked to a lot of people and heard a lot of people say, I just feel it in my bones. You know, something's coming. Yeah. And they're turning back to God. Because they're feeling it. And, you know, beyond that, all they need to do is, like, you're showing a bunch of articles.
Yeah.
It is what it is. And even, like, another proof for the biblical flood. You posted an article a few days ago about the vast oceans underneath the crust of the earth.
Yep.
More water under the earth than it's on top of it in our oceans. Well, back in the book of Genesis, you know, people always used to laugh and say, oh, 40 days of rain, how could that flood the earth? Well, that wasn't the main flooding of the earth. It says the great deeps burst forth, and the water that was stored under the crust surged to the surface of the earth along with the rain, and that's what smoked everyone.
Yeah.
So, you know, is so much biblical archaeology coming out, scientific evidence coming out that what the Bible says is true. People got to take a minute to assess their beliefs and their animosities or prejudices against Christ and the Christian faith, because it's all coming, being laid out very plainly for people in these days.
Well, and you know, also the remembrance, Father, that once again, most of this is not sourced from New Testament. There is exactly book and maybe six chapters in the New Testament that deal with such things. The majority of this comes from the book of Daniel, comes from older prophets, Malachi, you know, things like that. So, yeah, most of this does not come from the New Testament. The New Testament is the new promise. It's a promise of a new world of faith, a new world of salvation. You know, most of it, and even whenever you look at, once again, that capital I interpretation of the book of Revelation, when you start looking at especially books written of a time, about a time, you know, specifically books meant to give faith to people in a time of crisis, like the book of Revelation was, if you start looking at it through that lens, then you really do start seeing a lot more of the history inside of the book and the message of hope that was being given to the faithful of the time, you know, regarding the signs of their time right then, you know, because that's what it's not necessarily talking about the signs of the time of the future. It's the fact of these signs of the times are repeated over and over and over, much like the article that I popped up just a minute ago talking about the Earth's inner core has slowed down and reversed. We know why, because it's a cyclical thing. Like we can actively show in science, in lava flows, where magnetite, as it cools in a lava flow, is fixed to magnetic north, and sometimes magnetic north is 180 degrees the other way, meaning that the poles actively flipped, you know, meaning that the inner core has flipped, that this stuff moves, and it moves in a long, long cycle, but it's a cycle, you know, and humanity moves in a cycle. Like we forget in a cycle, you know, there's a reason why political parties change their doctrine about every 12 years, because we can only remember about every 8. Everything past that is seen through a filter.
Our history.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, it's important to look at these books through the lens of history, people, for the audiences that they were written for. But also, once again, in that term of no different than looking at the Constitution and projecting it out 200 years.
Yeah.
How does this document as it stands today project out to humanity 200 years from now? You know, and you can do the same thing with the Bible. How does the Bible as it was written then project out 2000 years to humanity as it stands now? And do these signs of the time still resonate with the humanity that we are? And unfortunately, yes, they do. Yes, they died. I'd love to say that they don't. But if you start going through and looking at that, man, like, yeah, I can see how doomsday cults are started. I can absolutely see that. And once again, I can in my heart of hearts empathize with every person in one because of that deep seated belief, you know, because even I have deep seated belief sometimes that I have to put in check. Because it may blind me, you know, in research or what have you, it may blind me somehow. So I need to set my deep-seated faith aside for the moment and look at this with open eyes, open heart, you know, doesn't change my faith to do so. Just opens the mind to be able to do so and gives me a new application of the knowledge. You know, which I think a lot of people really need when it comes to these doomsday prophecies, when it comes to the prophecies of the end of time as laid out in the scripture, because we're in a very delicate time right now, Father. I can't I can't even imagine being a shepherd of souls as you are. It's a tough and trying time. What can people do with their families to help quell some of this concern? Some of the, because I mean, we've hit on some hard topics tonight. We've hit on some hard stuff that's moving once again rapidly in the world around us, rapidly moving. So what can families do? What can people do to quell their mind, to put themselves at ease, know that there is peace, know that things will be better, Archbishop?
The biggest thing is, you know, as a bishop, I'll tell it from more time I wake up to the time I go to bed. Put your faith in Christ. In him, he's the only one that won't let you down. Everyone else on earth will let you down. But
pretty much.
God is the same, you know. Solidify the relationships you have in life, you know. If, you know, I watch a lot of prepper programs, and if, you know, SHTF happens, you know, where everything's gone down the crapper, you're going to need those relationships to know who you can trust, who you can rely on, who you can work with, barter, trade, etc., especially if a digital currency becomes a tyrannical issue. Trade. You know, black market, like we used to do back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, that'll be a big thing. Relationships. The biggest, you know, people always ask, what's the meaning of life? At its core, it's this. And it's a very simple answer. Love God with every fiber of your being and love your neighbor as yourself. You know, if you do those two things and put your faith in God and in Christ, you'll be solid. But it won't stop the rest of the world from doing what the world's going to do. At some point, it'll be the end of the age. The world itself will never end. I mean, it's not going to, you know, blow up and go into little space chunks. But an age is ending. A new age is coming. And I'm not talking like, you know, foo-foo philosophical kind of new age. I'm talking God on earth, God present, as the book of Revelation says, as well as the Old Testament prophets. You know, it's coming. It will be here one day. And when Christ comes back, he's ruling with a rod of iron, it says. So there won't be any voting on what people think is best. There won't be any, you know, democracy or anything else. It'll be Christ the King monarchy. And when that happens, there will be peace. There will be joy. There will be eternal life on earth in glorified bodies. And that's the beautiful thing. A lot of people, you know, as heavy as Revelation is, as heavy as the prophecies are, Christ coming back is called the blessed hope. That is what we can hope for. That is what we can, you know, sink our teeth into and stand firm for God on that, to know that no matter what else happens around us, we're still going to be okay at the end of the day. Because, you know, there's an old saying, sometimes he calms the storm, other times he calms his child. And that's exactly where we're at today in this world. If I didn't know the things I know and have studied the things I've studied and believe the things I believe, I'd be a basket case. I'd be a nervous wreck, because everything around us seems like it's a sea of chaos. But understand that in God and in Christ, it is a fortress against anything that may come against a person. Emotionally, mentally, intellectually.
Yeah.
But there's another old saying, you got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. That's exactly what I was going to say. I was like, you can call it religious fervor. You can call it religious conviction. You can call it conviction in knowing yourself and knowing what you stand for and believe in if you want to. I don't care. Like we can go full on AA with this, Padre, as far as I'm concerned. Like, hey, if it's the tree next door that is the source bigger than you in the universe, awesome. As long as there is something bigger than you, understand that you are not the, how's it working out for you? You know, be like, you've been able to solve all these problems yourself, right? Even having going through that court ordered at one point in life, it was one of those like, this was an amazing program to go through and kind of get a grasp on yourself and get a grasp on what you do know of yourself. And when you need to cry out for help and know that it's okay to cry out for help and know that there is a force in the universe that you participate in that is there to help you. And I've kind of been with that in mind, the last couple minutes, I'd like to explore the topic of, just that taking the Lord's name in vain. That's one that I have been on pretty hardcore since this revelation recently, Father. And that's the idea that because yes, Kabbalistically, things like that, because we were breathed life into by the Creator, our words mean something. We can manifest amazing things in the world around us. Most of the time, we should not have to call on the All Father to help us, because we should be able to manifest that help ourselves. We should be able to take care of that. And it's when you call on that, when you should be able to handle it yourself, that I believe is the moment that you're taking the Lord's name in vain, because now you're crying wolf. You're asking for help when you don't necessarily need it, you know, and not that it's not a panic child response, absolutely, but it's the idea of sometimes, folks, the Lord and the universe wants you to work your problem out. It wants you to do your homework, kids. I used to pray to pass geometry all the time. You know what God wanted me to do? Study my God blessed geometry, man. He wanted me to go home and study my geometry is what he wanted me to do, my end of the work. You know, and I think all too often people get scared away from a religious path because of religion, be a spiritual path because those things are not manifesting the way that they believe they should manifest. And you know, it's that idea of when you blow out the birthday candle, is your wish going to manifest the exact way you wished it? Or should you be open-minded and be looking for the ways in which it may have manifested? You know, so blessings can sometimes come in you not getting what you prayed for, people.
100%.
You know? And we have to remember that. We have to remember that. So yeah, like as you're preparing yourselves, as you're preparing your families for these things, as you're having these conversations with your families, which you should, people, whether you are religious or not, these are trying times in our humanity. These are trying times. Be open with your children. Be open with them. Listen to your children when they come to you with concern about these things in the world. Be open with them, be real, you know.
Because I do.
Yeah, same.
I tell my kids the truth. You know, I try to make it not as scary, but I still tell them the truth.
Yeah.
They need to know.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's what I have always considered, even whenever I taught religion and spirituality in Sunday school. That is what I held true is my job is not to teach your children why they need to come to church on Sunday. That's your job with the baptismal promise, parents. My job is to educate their heart and their conscience and make them understand that there is a choice out there for them to make.
Yeah.
And to help enable them to make a good leveraged choice spiritually. That's my job, you know. That was the charge that I took on as teacher was that I'm going to be honest where you may have lied to your children. I may be very bluntly honest with them. because that's my job, you know. And it was always interesting to see their response to that, you know, to like invite them into my classroom. If you have a problem, feel free to come on in. We'll chat. You can be part of the conversation if you want. So, yeah, it's important, like you said, to make sure that families understand these things, that families have conversations about it, that faith-filled families have conversations about it, that non-faith-filled families have conversations about it, and where they lie and what they believe and why they believe it. That's important. It's important. So thank you for the time tonight. Before we go, you do actively have an event that you are speaking at coming up soon. Tickets are available on Eventbrite. It's coming up in Bridgeport, Connecticut. You will be one of the virtual speakers at the Defeating the Demonic Conference. You spoke at this last year as well, correct?
Correct, yeah. And we had a couple hundred people in attendance, and myself and four other exorcists and ministers all spoke, and we had a great time. You know, there was lunches and meet and greets, the whole nine yards.
Yeah,
it was nice.
Awesome. Awesome. And you know, once again, an amazing topic, the idea that whether you see it as demonic, whether you see it as negative energy, what have you, folks, there is a surmounting force in our world. I tell my wife and my child, well, my wife more than my child, because I don't want my child to think it yet, truly. But every time my wife leaves the house, I tell her, take care, honey. I love you. The world hates good people.
Yeah.
You know, just keep being you, man. Because, yeah, there is something out there that just wants good to not prevail. You can call it evil. You can call it devil. You can call it just the flip side of the coin of humanity if you want. But there is a force out there that doesn't want good to prevail. So thank you for the collar that you wear, Father. Thank you for the crook with which you guide the souls that you do. It is good people like you out there. Like I am, I've sat on the show numerous times, and you know, I don't walk into buildings for such things anymore. But I laud everybody who does. And I sing the praises of everybody who finds their way to that door every week. If that is what it takes for you to reach the divine and to talk to the divine and to experience that, run to it. So thank you for that. Thank you for your time as always.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So, well, on that note, folks, thank you so much for always tuning in. Let everybody know where they can go to buy tickets for that, where they can go to find your works, where they can go to find your books, Father.
Well, my book is on Amazon. It's an exorcist journey, walking with the paranormal, an exorcist journey. My brain's can all.
That's all right.
We've been talking about, but, yeah. And then of course the event that I'll be speaking at in October, Defeating the Demonic, a lot of good guys on there. We pretty much lay it out, you know, tell you the truth. We're not there to coddle anyone or to make people feel good. We're there to tell them the truth.
Yeah. It's not a membership drive.
What they do with it, that's on them. And yeah. So last year was a great success. This year I expect will be a great success. But look forward to seeing folks participate, learn a few things, and maybe clean out a few skeletons out of the closet on the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you as always for your time. It's always great chatting with you. It's always great really delving into these hard topics of spirituality and religion. And it's great to be able to have somebody like you who is open to mind, open of heart, to be able to share those things. So thank you so much. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out An Exorcist Journey by Father Archbishop James Cloud on Amazon. Everybody, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can go to buy all of the books, courses, movies, things like that from our guests, everybody. That is also where you can reach Curious Research. Curious Research is our new endeavor for archiving the paranormal, archiving UFOs, things like that. If you are a researcher and you have an archive of data that you need to digitize, remember, research does not happen in a vacuum. That's why the internet was created, was so that researchers could talk and share data. So get a hold of us. Let's make sure to get your data digitized and available in the new world so that more researchers can get a hold of it and we can get to the bottom of these things happening in the world around us. Thank you, as always, everybody, for tuning into the show. It is your open minds, your open hearts that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.